On this episode of the Actual Fluency Podcast, I'm joined by Anthony Lauder, who talks about the development from polynaut to polyglot. Do you like audiobooks? Well, then Audible is for you. If you go to actualfluency.com/book, you can choose a free audiobook from a selection of 150,000 titles. Are you thinking about starting your own language learning website? Then check out HostGator. Use the coupon code ACTUALFLUENCY to get your first month for just 1 cent. Get started by going to actualfluency.com/HostGator.
Welcome to the Actual Fluency Podcast, the podcast that gives you the tools and inspiration to learn languages faster and more efficiently. And now your host, Chris Broholm.
Hello, hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Actual Fluency Podcast, the podcast for language learners and aspiring polyglots. My name is, as always, Chris Broholm, and if you have any questions, comments, or even concerns, you're very welcome to email me at chris@actualfluency.com. Today's episode is a very interesting one. It's with Anthony Lauder, who you might have seen on YouTube and his Fluent Czech channel, or in the Polyglot Budapest conference, where he was giving a fantastic talk about what it means to be a polyglot and what it means to be a polynaut. And today we're diving into Anthony's kind of distilled wisdom that he's learned over the years as he's learned himself Czech and is now working on learning himself even more languages. So before I throw you over to the interview with Anthony Lauder, I just wanted to give a little background for this interview because I think you might find it interesting. I originally contacted Anthony quite a while ago and said that I was interested in interviewing him, and he immediately agreed and he said, yes, let's do it. And then, you know, we were both busy, a lot of things came up. And then finally, 2 weeks ago, we found a kind of a time where we both were able to do the interview at the same time. And then at the day of the interview, only a few hours before, I get the message that Anthony has suffered an ear infection. And obviously, if you guys ever tried to have an ear infection, it's quite painful to listen to anything, to have a headset on or earbuds. It's all very painful. And to make matters worse, it had burst his eardrum so that he was definitely out of commission for any interview-related activities. And unfortunately, that led to episode 27, along with other, you know, problems, but that led to episode 27, which is this one, being delayed for a week. And the interesting thing was then when we tried to record again, when Anthony said, okay, I'm healthy now, I had just been hit with an incredibly persistent cold, which made my voice sound quite, let's just say, bad. I mean, you might still detect a remnant of it today, but it's gotten much, much, much better. So I can finally record, and I can also speak for half an hour or 45 minutes without my throat completely giving up on me. So that meant that we had to push it yet another week. And then Anthony was like, oh, crap, I'm going on holiday that week. And I was like, okay, well, I guess we'll never get the Anthony Lauder interview. But then some good things happened. His girlfriend decided to push their vacation a week due to work commitments. And that's how I actually managed to get the interview with Anthony going for this week. But of course, you know, an interview like this with such a backstory is not complete without some technical problems. So during the interview, I actually lost, first, my computer decided to stop recording, which meant that we had to take a 2-3 minute break while I got the recorder working again. And then 5 minutes later, Skype decided to drop the call, and then we had to get that back. And so it was just basically the interview that was never supposed to happen, I suppose, but me and Anthony persevered, and ironically, in the interview itself, we talk about not giving up, and that's exactly what we did today. So I hope you enjoyed the interview with Anthony Lauder, and as always, keep learning and never give up. All right, everyone, today is the day where we make the impossible happen. I'm finally joined by none other than Anthony Lauder. Anthony is an English expat now living in Czech Republic, and he was responsible for probably the best presentation at a polyglot event so far, at least. Anthony, I'm so happy we could finally meet up. How are you doing this fine morning?
I'm doing very well, thank you. And I must just say about that conference presentation, you're very kind to say it was the best. But in fact, I followed a piece of advice that a colleague gave me many years ago, which is that when you're giving a presentation, the most important thing is to keep the audience awake.
Right.
So if I kept the audience awake, then I'm satisfied.
Oh, people are still talking about their presentation today.
Oh, that's very nice.
But we won't talk too much about it. I bet you've been asked lots of questions about that already. But and of course, a lot of people know you from that presentation, and maybe some of them have found your Fluent Czech videos on YouTube or some of your writing endeavors here and there. But if people haven't heard about you, could you take a second to just go back in time and introduce, how did you get into, well, what's your first experience with foreign language learning, and how did that bring you to, you know, a Polyglot conference teaching Czech and learning Czech maybe in the first place?
Sure. So I was always absolutely useless at learning languages, and it actually dates back to high school, where I was told I had to learn German because the French class was full. So they stuck me in the German class, and several months into the class, the teacher died, unfortunately, and they didn't have a replacement. And so instead, they brought in a guy who was a film fan, and he made us watch all these Second World War movies. Nothing to do with Germany at all, nothing to do with learning German, but we got to see a lot of action movies. And I thought, well, that was pretty useless, but I'm enjoying the movies at least. But I didn't learn any language skills in the slightest. So I forgot about languages for many years. I became sort of a geeky guy doing mathematical stuff, and I became a programmer and worked in that industry for many years until I retired 8 years ago when I was 42. And I thought, okay, best find a hobby. And I decided to do something I was really bad at, because what's the point of doing something you're good at? There's no challenge. So I remembered back, the thing I was worst at school was languages. So I thought, okay, now's the time to jump into it. And I decided, I'd been living in the Czech Republic for more than a year and couldn't say anything in Czech at all. I lived in an expat bubble, like most English speakers do. So I decided, time to get on with it. So I dived into learning Czech, mainly by the method of never giving up, which is my primary method.
Right. That's really interesting. And I guess that a lot of people have that same feeling of uselessness in school, particularly the early years where you're learning a language through these. We were just talking about this before we started recording, about how they make you kind of memorize things instead of promoting learning how to speak. For instance, I know all the German prepositions and what case they're in, but I can't form a sentence. Of course, now it's different, but back then, you know, that was the case. You know, we could do all the, and in English, it was the same. I am, you are, you know, you went through all the grammar kind of horizontally, but we didn't learn how to speak immediately. That was on our own. Is that the same you had?
Yeah, in fact, eventually, so I started teaching myself Czech, bought the small number of textbooks that does exist, and tried talking to people very badly. And after a couple of years of that, I decided I would go to university full time. There's a university called Charles University here in Prague, and they have a class where you sit an entrance exam, and they have hundreds of people studying Czech there each year. I took the entrance exam, and somehow I got the highest grade. I don't know how, but wow. Oh, you're the top. I guess because I studied the grammar tables a lot, because that's what they were mostly testing. They were testing grammar knowledge pretty much. And so I got put into the highest group, and I was the only person in the group that wasn't Russian. It's much easier for Slavic speakers to learn Czech.
Good for you.
There's a nice joke about that, actually, which is that once a week, well, at least for a few of the weeks until they stopped doing it, we actually had a lesson once a week on how to reduce your Russian accent.
Okay.
And they said to everybody, you've still got some Russian accent. And when he got to me, oh, well done, Anthony, no Russian accent at all. So, yeah, I'm good at something at last. Thank you for that. And right. But what was important was they kept teaching all this grammar stuff still, and they were teaching all sorts of weird exceptions and things in the grammar. and testing us constantly on how well we were doing in the grammar, and we would have to write essays and so on. But there wasn't very much speaking.
Right.
And my speaking didn't improve for quite a few months at all, really. It would still be sort of stuttering and halting until I decided, well, look, the best way to get good at speaking is to speak. So I started speaking with a particular friend twice a week, just for an hour each time. Not an immense amount of time, but within about 2 months, the university professor said to me, wow, your speaking ability is going really well. It's a massive improvement. And if I'd looked at the total amount of time I put into it, I would say it had been about 2 hours a week for 2 months. So not a lot, not a lot. But the speaking ability really increased. And I think that I sort of had all this passive knowledge of the language, and it activated very quickly. So it seemed I'd gone from zero to quite a high level very quickly. But in fact, it was all bubbling under the surface and it jumped up.
Right.
So I think that does happen, that you can do all this passive reading and think, I'm getting nowhere, I'm never going to speak. But you can then, once you reach a certain level of passive knowledge, when you can read everything and understand the news and all this kind of stuff, then the speaking, after you try it, does come quickly, but it doesn't come without effort.
Right.
You have to speak.
And what do you think about the whole throw yourself in there, learn a few phrases and just start speaking without that kind of grammar background? Because that's obviously been popularized recently by the release of Benny Lewis's book and his blog.
Yes. So I think that there are two things that I want to say to that. The first one is, I think that's a fantastic way of getting over the fear of making mistakes. Because one problem at university, when we were having the occasional speaking sessions, is they would pounce on every little mistake you made. Oh, no, that's not in the accusative, that's in the genitive, or something like this. You gave the wrong ending. And you think, what the hell? This is hardly a welcoming environment. When you get out into the street and you know you're bad and you get over the fear, then I think that's a very important step where you think, look, the most important thing is getting the message across. You're not going to be perfect, but you get the message across. And I think that knowing you're going to be bad and just accepting it is one advantage of starting early. It sets your expectations low so you can't disappoint yourself. And I really think that's a very good thing. And also, I've said this to a lot of people, that in reality, most real-world conversations are pretty trivial. They are pretty superficial. You know, a ticket to the town centre, please, when you're on the bus, or can I have a pound of chicken when you're in the supermarket, or so on. Or, how are you doing? Yes, I'm doing well. It's not discussing Eisenbaum's theory of metamorphic dualism.
No. But that sounds interesting, though.
So, you know, this kind of thing is realistic. Most conversations are simple. And one of the things I do, I guess a lot of language learners do this, is when I know I'm going on vacation to a new country, I set myself a goal of only using the language of that country. And sometimes I have a long time to prepare for it, sometimes a short time. So last year I went to Italy for 10 days and I didn't really know any Italian at all. I had 7 weeks to go before I booked it at the last minute. So I absolutely threw myself into Italian, hours and hours and hours a day, doing the Pimsleur course and Michelle Thomas and reading books and all these things and watching the news and so on. And when I got there, I did only speak Italian for 10 days. Huh? And it sounds impressive, but it isn't impressive because most of the interactions were very trivial.
Of course.
You know, just going into shops or into the museum, asking people basic questions, talking to tourists, swapping pleasantries and so on. And then they'll ask simple questions like, where are you from? But it gives you a confidence. It makes you not afraid and not getting over that fear and realizing that your achievements will not be magnificent, but they'll be good enough. That I think that really is important.
Like a mindset change. It's not about your level. It's about how you think about the whole going into it.
Well, one of the things I said at that conference presentation you were talking about is that you can have a conversation with just 10 words as long as you're realistic about what your conversation will be. And now here's one thing. A lot of people say that, well, that might be okay. You can use your 10 words or however many words you've got. But when the person replies to you, you won't understand what they're saying. And that just isn't true, because people adjust their list responses to your level. If you meet somebody on the street and he says something like, "Where station for train?" You think, okay, this is a person who's not very advanced, so I'll use really simple words.
Of course.
And that's what everybody does. So everybody, because everybody wants to come, this is something I wrote about actually with my conversational connectors, which maybe we can talk about in a little while, which is that everybody wants conversations to be pleasant.
Right.
So both sides are putting effort into making that the case.
And when you're new, that might be difficult to figure out what exactly that means. And that's why you came up with this, I guess, concept of filling the blanks, so to speak, between the facts. Let's just talk about that now. I think we should. I think it's a good time. So conversational connectors, they're in Benny's book as well. And I think your name is there as well.
Yes, I introduced Benny to the idea because I had this revelation one day that I was listening to conversations and very little of what was actually happening in the conversation was information exchange. Some of it was. So somebody might say, "I want a chicken. Give me 10 euros. Here are 10 euros. Here is your chicken." But that's not how conversations tend to happen. Instead, there's a load of other stuff going around. Things like, "Could you help me, please? I would like to have a chicken." "Ah, yes, of course, sir. I'd be very pleased to do that." "Well, the price of ours today is 10 euros. Oh, in my opinion, that's very reasonable." You know, like this. So a lot of that stuff is nothing to do with chickens and 10 euros. It's conversational stuff. And the important thing about this conversational stuff is that it applies to every conversation you have. So once you've learned a lot of basic vocabulary, you can string it together with these pre-learned conversational things in any situation. And it's far more useful and far more reusable than learning a load of very rare words. Yeah. So once you've learned the basic 10 or 20 words or 100 words or whatever you decide for things like money and taxi and hello and all these kind of things, then I learned to do this myself, to capture by listening to lots of conversations, these things I call conversational connectors and I call them conversational connectors for two reasons. One is they connect strings of words together. But more importantly, they connect people together in a conversation.
Right.
So I made categories for these, such as, filler is one of them, which is whenever you're terrified, "I forgot a word," you just fill it in with these time fillers. Like, "Now that's a very interesting idea. And while I think about it, I would like the green one." And while you're saying those first ones, you've thought of the word for green.
Right.
But some of them actually have functions. So you would say things like, "I have to say, I don't really like that idea. What do you think?" So that's passing over the baton to keep the conversation going, that kind of thing. So, as you said, in Benny's book, he picked up on this. He actually said that, "Oh, that's a nice idea. I'm going to do that with all languages now." And a few people picked it up. Actually, if people search for conversational connectors, quite a few people have translated mine because they were Czech and English.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of people translated them into something like 20 different languages now.
Oh, that's fantastic, actually.
Yeah.
I really like the idea.
Yeah. And I actually was very grateful because I took some of these translations and I learned my own connectors that other people had translated into other languages and then used them as I've been learning new languages. So for example, now I'm very heavily involved in learning Spanish and because I'm going to be going to Spanish speaking countries next year. So I've given myself a few months to get really good in Spanish and I've been learning the connectors that some kind people translated for me.
Awesome. And do you just use, is there any practical tips people should know about learning, 100 different, maybe not all of them, but maybe learn a few from each group and then put it into Anki or something? Would that be what you do? Or
in fact, I don't. I actually have this method of my own. I don't want to force my language learning method on people because people have, I think the best thing is to work your own language learning method out. But I've got one that I call a spiral method. Uh-huh. And I made actually three videos of talking about it and giving a sample session of me using the spiral method, and it's on my YouTube channel. So if people, rather than me describe it, look on there. But the main essence of it is, it's a way to practice joining things together.
Right.
But on your own. So you record your voice, you even record a video of yourself, and I have a whiteboard I write things on and I build up sentences and so on. Because the most important skill for output is to combine things well. When you're learning, you learn all these fragments, you know, little bits, little chunks. But to combine them into a stream of stuff is actually the whole learning process for output is learning how to combine things.
Right. That's how language works. I mean, even your native language, you don't have a set of memorized sentences. All the sentences we're saying now have never been spoken. Never.
Oh. Wow.
That's how unique we are. No, that's just, you know, brain from linguistics 101, you know, but that's basically the idea that we generate every sentence based on our fragmental knowledge, like you say. We don't remember, like I haven't memorized what I'm just saying now and then repeating it. So you're saying that we should adapt that for kind of foreign languages as well and not just do the repeating there.
Right. So if you stick into Anki, a load of stuff to learn, you'll learn all these fragments, you'll learn all these words or short phrases you put into that, but you will not learn how to combine them dynamically on an as-needed basis. But once you've learned that, then new thing, as you learn new words and phrases, you can just plug them in. And this is Luca. Mm-hmm. Talks about this epiphany point where you think, oh, it's all clicking now. And I think a lot of this epiphany point is where you've learned to combine things with ease in the language. And so then he says, oh, and then your learning speed goes really quickly. And what I think is actually happening is because you've learned to express yourself, new words to combine things in a language, new words will just fall into that then rather than being isolated.
Right.
Yeah. And so I think that this spiral method that I use is really useful at getting you to this ability to combine stuff. Yeah.
I'll definitely put a link to it so people can find it easily, the videos. And also I'll try and find the connectors. I found the Czech ones, but I'm sure if I spend a little bit more time, I can find for the other languages as well, if people are interested.
Sure.
So. Sure. I think an interesting question about when you got into language learning is, you know, what made you kind of not accept things as they were? Was it lack of results or was it lack of results or are you naturally kind of inquisitive into meta learning and what makes us learn?
Right. So I always need to dig into something very deeply. That's the kind of background I have. I was an academic for a long time and I worked in research labs in the States. And then I did my PhD and I was a postdoctoral research fellow at university for a few years. And all of that is about really digging deep into something to actually understand what's really going on here. And I thought, look, can I apply the same thing into language learning for myself, such as why am I so bad at talking? So I dug into it and I monitored conversations and thought about them. And I thought, yeah, this connector stuff is real. And from that, then I started getting really into this idea of don't just learn the stuff, but think about it and dig into it. And I found that it actually helps me. Yeah.
Right. And what would you say is your biggest finding? I suppose if you're a researcher, then you're often looking to find something. Do you have any kind of big revelations that pertains to this? Maybe the conversational connectors, obviously, we already talked about. But did you have any big, like you see the big cartoonish light bulb and you're like, I've been doing it all less efficiently than I could, or...
Oh, well, in fact, this is a very important thing because I made a video interview a few months ago where I talked about this, which is, it isn't revolutionary, but it really struck me. And so that the main way to fail in language learning is to give up. That's it. And as long as you plug away at it, it sinks in, but it doesn't feel like it. That's the big, that's the main thing. You feel you're not making progress.
Right.
But you are. And if you just do, people do say, oh, I've been learning Spanish for 3 years and I'm getting nowhere. And that's because they give up lots of times and come back to it 2 weeks later. And they're all, I had friends doing this with learning Czech. One of my female friends here, she arrived in the country around the same time as me. And for the first year or two, we were both terrible at Czech. And she then saw me starting to make progress by plugging away day after day after day. And every now and again, we'd be out somewhere and she'd see me having a conversation with somebody and she'd get, oh no, he's got more advanced than I have. So she'd go home and she told me, I'm going to really hit the textbooks tonight. Oh. And she'd put in a 3-hour session and then get disillusioned and then take a week off and then do the same thing. Right. So when we talk about people giving up, it's not that people give up permanently. It's they give up for short chunks of time. Oh, I'm going to give up now. And then they come back to it a month later. And then they give up and they come back to it a month later. And that kind of stuff just leads to frustration. So the biggest lesson I had is giving up, not on even on a micro scale.
Right.
Is the only route to failure. And I'm guilty of it myself sometimes. Sometimes I do think for example, I was learning German and I got to a pretty basic level in German on my own. But I thought, I'll take a few weeks off. And then I never got back to it.
Right.
Yeah.
You know? So the habit is the important. Yeah,
just keep going and it sinks in. So it's not a great revelation, but personally, my personal message to myself is never take more than a day or two off. And when you think you're not learning, just plug away.
Right.
In fact, when I was at high school, this was an important lesson in life. I remember being at high school and we do the end of year examinations in any subject, let's say in physics. And I would go, my God, this is tough. Oh my God, I hope I pass it. And then I'd pass it, you know, but it seemed like the hardest thing in the world. 6 months later, I'd look back at that old paper and think, why didn't I get 100%? It's so easy.
Right.
And I find that sometimes it helps me to do that with language learning, where I think, my God, this is so tough. I'm not making any progress. Then I go back and look at lesson one or two in the book and I think, well, that's easy. So
that's great.
You obviously have made progress. So look back.
Is it like, I guess it's like measuring your arms and legs when you're trying to lose weight and it looks like you're getting nowhere. And then you realize that you've lost 10 inches or something off your...
right. Yeah, because we're always focused on the stuff we're doing now. So this is a great phenomenon that happens in computer science. Well, not just in computer science, in any area of research. When you're doing a PhD, and PhD supervisors often warn about this, and it's that anything that you don't know seems impossibly difficult. Everything that you do know seems ridiculously trivial.
Mm.
So a lot of people drop out of their PhD because they think, oh, I'm reading this person's research and I don't understand it. It's so sophisticated. That guy must be far more intelligent than me. And then you look at what you've produced yourself. And because you know it really well, you think, well, that stuff's obvious. I've not produced anything worthwhile.
It should have a name. I feel like this should have a name, this phenomenon.
Yeah, I don't know what the name would be, but I think it happens in language learning that the stuff you do know, you think, yeah, well, I know that, but it's not the hard stuff. The hard stuff is still ahead.
Right.
And because you don't understand the hard stuff, you get intimidated by it and you trivialize what you do know already. So I sometimes think about that too.
Like going back and measuring your arms and seeing how far you've actually come.
Right. And realizing also that there's this book I'm reading at the moment for Spanish. It's called Spanish for Reading. It's a very good book. And I'm more than halfway through it, probably two-thirds of the way through it. And it's quite difficult. But I remember thinking that with the first couple of chapters, and now I look back at them and I think, well, that's really trivial.
Right.
And that is a way for me to realize, despite all my self-delusion and my brain tricking me, I have actually made some progress.
Right. Our brain is fantastically good at deceiving us and giving illusions, whether they are of inferiority or grandeur, but
yes,
they definitely work. I always think about that proverbial hill where you just keep going up, 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 and you're like, oh, I can't get up this hill because it's too steep. But then you get to the drop point where it's just cruising from there. And would you say that happens in language learning as well, where you reach a point where it suddenly starts becoming easy?
Well, this is Luca's idea of the epiphany point, and I think it happens not on an input basis, because you can always find more complicated stuff to read.
Right.
And so you never feel comfortable with reading. You always can find something that's too complicated. So you can reach a survival level where you think, okay, I can read the simple stuff. But with output, when you actually feel I can talk about any topic, even if you're having to talk around it, you know. So I think for example, with Czech, and I think probably with French, probably, I can now talk about anything. Even if I'm missing some vocabulary, let's say you can talk at the level of a 10-year-old child, where a 10-year-old child can talk about anything.
Of course, yeah.
Even if they're missing vocabulary. So you could discuss your job or your studies to a 10-year-old child, but they might not know all the words, but still you can both have a very solid conversation about that. And that point, when you reach that point, I think is when it all starts to feel much, much easier.
Right, and more natural as well, because
more natural.
I guess if you think about it, in your native language, there are definitely topics that you don't know the words for. Could be very technical topics, could be very sciencey topics or something like that. And you can still talk around it by using, oh, that thing, or you know what I mean. And again, connectors, right?
Exactly. And this is one of the things that connectors taught me, how to be able to talk around topics and slot in your vocabulary, no matter how limited your vocabulary is. So this brings me to fluency. As I said before, I like to really dig into things and understand what they are. And fluency, what is fluency, is one of the ongoing debates. And people get into either very, very heated arguments about it, or they say there are too many definitions, let's not bother talking about it.
Right.
So I decided, fine, I'll come up with my own definition based on partly what other people are saying, but partly on my own beliefs. And fluency to me relates to things flowing. So it isn't about the amount of vocabulary you have. It isn't about having a native accent. It's about your conversations flowing.
Right.
So that means, as we discussed earlier, you can keep the conversation going, both for you and the other person. Anybody could have a monologue. And when we record videos of ourselves speaking a foreign language, that isn't a conversation, that's a monologue. A conversation flows between people. So I always see it as flowing to that person and flowing back to me. And it's almost like passing the ball, and we're keeping it flowing. So fluency for me is an ability to keep a conversation flowing in a way that is not painless for the other person.
Right.
Sorry, that is painless, that is not painful for the other person.
Yeah.
Not painful for the other person.
I got that.
So if you say, train, that's painful for the other person, and they will try to end the conversation.
Right.
To avoid that pain.
Switch to English if you're in...
I'll switch to English. Oh, yeah. So you have achieved fluency, I believe, when the person that you're speaking with wants the conversation to continue.
Finds it pleasurable to the ears as well as the brain.
Mm. So I thought, if it's not about vocabulary, can we become fluent with what we have? And this is one of the things that was at the heart of Conversational Connectors. And it's my sort of slogan, be fluent with what you have.
Right. You should write a book.
Oh, thank you. You think so?
Yeah. Sorry, I think it would be a great idea for a book, like how to, well, of course, you would have to probably add some more stuff than just the connectors, but
sure.
Talk about the low kind of practical approach to language learning and how that's different from all the let's learn 10 languages in a year kind of things going around.
Well, yes, this is a very important thing that I believe that I'm a pretty poor language learner. I'm not a super guru. I'm not linguistically magnificently talented. But I believe I show to myself, and hopefully a few others see, that even a man with limited abilities like me can actually make progress and do pretty well. And so I guess my advice is aimed not at superstars, but normal human guys who've got limits and so on. And so I cannot say to people, I can teach you to be fluent in a few days. I can give you a native-like accent, any of that. I think my advice is, if you're just an ordinary person and you want to be able to have conversations, I can help you get there eventually. My book would not have any grand claims at all if I wrote one. It would have quite humble ambitions, but I think humble ambitions are probably fair for the majority of us.
Yeah, and they're kind of a rarity right now, I would say, because it's all about how fast can we learn a language and how quickly can we remember hundreds of words. And
sure.
And I totally see the whole connectors, and from a personal level, that's what I've been missing in my language learning. Mm. Because I've always done the whole learn a lot of vocabulary, even if it's my German, which I've had for 8 years in school, which maybe 8 years is probably a bad thing to say. I'm considering to start saying 350 hours at most, because, 8 years in school, that's nothing when you take the hours. Just the fact that we're not in school one third of the year, or more than one third of the year, I find quite amazing. But, vacations and weekends, they take up a lot. Yeah. So for me, it was always, well, I know a lot of words, meaning I can understand a lot, but producing I can't because I haven't worked on, well, now we call them connectors, but back then I wouldn't even known why I couldn't speak. I would just say, oh, well, it must be because I'm missing words. And right. I guess that's true. I am missing words, but it's not the word itself I'm missing. It's the phrase, the combination of words.
Right. So this whole idea of combining stuff. In fact, I've told this story a few times, but I will say it again, that I've taught a few people here in Prague how to do this with Czech. And I remember the first person that I did it with, it was a woman who knew a massive vocabulary, but she couldn't say anything at all. And so I just had, I don't know, 3 one-hour lessons teaching her some basic connectors. And a lot of the connectors, by the way, are, there's only you could probably learn 50 initially, or even fewer, and then be able to have quite good conversations. And now I've got hundreds of them, and many of them are just new ways of saying the same thing. So a nice example of this is if you can, and mixing it up then, just using ones that to replace other ones makes the conversations less repetitive. So an example is something like, I think, or I believe, or in my opinion, or if you ask me, all these things are all saying the same thing. So you only need to learn one of them initially. So in the first 3 hours, I taught her one from each category. So maximum of 50 of these phrases, probably fewer. And I would take her out into the town center and give her little 1 minute missions. So I remember the very first one she had, which is, we walked past an ice cream parlor and she said, oh, I wouldn't mind some of that. And I said, okay, your first 1 minute mission is to ask to taste 3 of those ice creams, but you don't want to buy them. You just want to taste them. And she went, well, don't come with me. I'll be too embarrassed in front of you. Fine, we'll go and do it. So off she went and she came back and I'm not kidding, we're skipping up the street. And she said, it was amazing. I did it, I did it, I got that. And I thought, oh, that's really nice. She got, just because it wasn't an important conversation, she wasn't solving a world crisis or anything. She was doing something really simple, just getting to taste 3 different ice creams. And the joy she felt from it, and that positive joy kept her going with it. So you do get a lot of pleasure from your very first actual conversations where something happens. This is another thing. I believe that I get very motivated by things that make something happen. So for her, she was motivated by getting to taste three pieces of ice cream and so on. But I'm not motivated by something just because I'm supposed to do it. So learning a list of vocabulary in a book just because it's in the book is not motivating for me at all. I'll put the effort in, but my heart isn't in it.
Right. I love that from the, if I can just interrupt you for a second, yeah. I love the part about your talk where you say, what is the point of learning the name of 20 different types of fish?
Yes.
I don't even know what they're called in English.
That's right. Exactly. Exactly. Yes. Yes.
That's hilarious. And I have the same feeling in Danish. I'm like, is that a fish or is that the name of an Asian dish or something? You know, right. I have no idea.
Yeah. So, and I think one big advantage that experienced language learners, polyglots, have is that they have an intuitive feel for what's worth knowing. So they can extract the useful stuff from a textbook because they've been through the process so many times. They know which bits to skip over just intuitively. Oh, yeah, I should focus on that. I'll ignore that. But when you're completely new to it, everything has equal weight and you keep thinking, should I be learning this? Blah, blah, blah. Yeah. So one of the reasons I believe learning languages becomes much easier as you've learned, after you've learned the first one or two, is because you get an intuitive feel for what's worth focusing on. And you cannot teach that to somebody. You cannot say to somebody, this is the stuff that's worth focusing on. They have to go through that process themselves. So the first language you learn is going to be a lot of self-doubt, but the self-doubt slips away.
Right.
When you move on to later ones.
And if you're ambitious like me and pick Russian first, then when you're done, you feel like you can learn anything, right?
Yes. That's, in fact, I have to tell you that when I was learning Czech, I was crying because it was, some nights I would be crying because it was so difficult.
Wow.
For example, the declension tables for noun cases, for people who don't know what that's about, it just means that each word has many, many different forms that you have to change the form of the word in different situations. So in Czech, every word has seven different forms in the singular and seven different words in the plural. And there are 57 tables of these 14 declensions. And so there are books with the 57 different sets of patterns in. And to remember all those is very difficult. And to be able to use them down just on the fly automatically, to have this automaticity so that it just automatically comes out, it takes a lifetime or longer. And so I was crying some nights with this because it was so difficult. And then when I was learning Italian and now with Spanish, I'm crying at the pleasure that you don't have to learn that stuff, that it doesn't have those things. Of course, it has its own difficulties, but the fact that once you've learned a word, you don't have to learn 14 different ways of saying it. Right. I was crying with pleasure. Yeah.
Who needs that many declensions? I mean, it's incredible.
Yes. So actually, I actually do wish that, well, I don't know, learning a totally different language as your first language, learning something like Russian, like you said, is really throwing yourself in at the deep end. And it is a very painful process. And maybe it would be better to start with a language that's close to your own. So for an English speaker to start with Spanish or French is going to be a much easier journey for them than starting with Spanish, with starting with Russian. However, if you have chosen something that's hellish like learning Russian, once you've done it, you'll think, well, if I could do that, I can do anything.
Right. But you're not often thinking that along the way, though. You're like, no. I need to stop doing this.
Yeah.
So I would actually say, you know, I would never say I've learned Russian. I've done it for about six, seven months now. And I'm a very lazy student. So it's not like it's been 2-3 hours a day. It's been a half to a whole hour a day at most.
Okay.
But what I can say is that if I could go back and do it again, I would probably, like you say, learn an easier language first to get some wins under the belt. Because I think that if I hadn't had the blog and, you know, everyone kind of looking at me, then I would probably have given up with it if I was just on my own. I wouldn't be able to summon the willpower. Luckily, I got to the Polyglot Berlin gathering. I kind of joined the family of language enthusiasts, so I had more motivation from there. But yeah, I would probably have given up if I was on my own. So I think it's very, very good tip to start with something. Well, it doesn't have to be, if you're German, it doesn't have to be Dutch. I mean, that's right. Probably a bit too easy. But if you're German, it could be Italian or Spanish or something European right. that you can ease into the learning process.
Yeah. But you mentioned going to the Polyglot gathering, and I would like to just say one thing about the polyglots that I've met, which is that the really very highly accomplished polyglots are incredibly humble. And when you go onto some forums and people like write very nasty comments and try to make you feel bad about yourself and point out your mistakes and so on, those are usually not very accomplished people. These very well accomplished polyglots that I've had the good fortune to meet, they have been the most encouraging, non-judgmental, nicest people possible. They're very busy, so don't bombard them with 1,000 emails. But if you approach them from time to time, you'll find they're very, very friendly. And any negativity that you get will usually be from less accomplished people.
Right.
And I think that was one of the big things I also noticed. I went to the Budapest Polyglot Conference. Yep. And I was amongst by the least accomplished people there, most certainly. I was, a polynot and surrounded by great polyglots, and they were extremely, extremely pleasant. It's a really nice community. So I do encourage people not to be intimidated and get involved into that community.
Right. It's a very humble community. I mean, a funny story from Berlin was that there was a guy there who was traveling around Europe with friends, and he wasn't in the community at all, interested in language learning. So he actually only spoke English. I speak a bit of French. No, it was only English. And people were so nice to him, he said, because I sat down with him at lunch just randomly. And I said, well, how do you feel about the whole thing? And he was like, it's awesome, you know? Mm. And I was like, so do you feel like learning a language? He was like, I guess a little bit. But I mean, the point is that he wasn't totally discouraged by it, even though he never had the interest in the first place.
Right.
Which I thought was incredible.
Yeah.
Can you imagine? I mean, I would never go to such an event with one language without knowing what kind of people were there, because then I would assume that everyone was just like, oh, you speak one language. Well, go see some sites or something. You know? but that's totally not the case. And in that ballpark, are you coming to one of the conferences, the upcoming conferences?
So I was actually I was intending to go to Berlin, but then some very unpleasant things happened in my personal life, which stopped me wanting to do that. And the Novi Sad one, it conflicted with some of the plans that I have, so I can't do it, unfortunately. Right. But I do know that there is one in New York next year sometime.
Oh, that's confirmed.
I thought it was. I thought it was.
Well, I just heard rumors about it, but I didn't know it was confirmed.
So I may be able to do that. The one difficulty is that next year I will be taking the whole year off to go. Well, I take every year off. I'm retired. but next year I'm hoping to spend the whole year traveling.
Right.
So it depends where I am.
But then Berlin next year could be an opportunity in May.
Next year?
Yeah.
Next May, I'll be in Patagonia.
Oh, that's a bit far then, isn't it?
Yes. I'm hoping, hopefully. One of the reasons I'm so heavily in Spanish is that the first 6 months of next year, I will be in South America traveling through all the countries of South America.
Fantastic.
And then in the second half of the year, I'm going to sort of come back home and travel around Europe.
Great. But then in New York, maybe I don't know if I can make it to New York. I hope so. But it's, of course, a continental flights are usually an arm and a leg. It's getting better, but
Yeah.
Still very expensive. But yeah. Anthony, I could sit here and listen to you all day, and I'm sure a lot of people feel the same way. But I want to just thank you for taking the time. And it's really exciting that we actually did make it happen in spite of several illnesses and technical problems.
Yeah, it was very unfortunate because we did have it set up a couple of times and both of us got sick.
That's just
but now
happens.
It happens. Yeah. And I hope I haven't just been rambling too much, but...
You know, I find this good rambling. And you definitely did the good part.
Thank you, Chris.
It's very exciting to hear because you're so excited about sharing your experiences. It's not about, well, this is how you do it kind of thing. It's like, oh, I figured this one out and then that helped me. It's not, it's not, this is how you definitely should do it and this is the only way. So, yeah, so I just want to thank you so much for coming on and I'll be sure to put every single resource we talked about in the comments in the blog post so people can watch your amazing talk, which I think has also the record for most slides in a talk ever.
262.
Oh, but cut down from
millions. Well, many more, yes. I really trimmed it down to the bare minimum to get to 262 slides in less than an hour. Yes. Okay.
That's amazing. All right. Thank you so much, Lorda, and have a fantastic day.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Listening to the Actual Fluency Podcast. For more information, be sure to check out actualfluency.com. Until next time, enjoy learning and have a great day.